this is the point at which I try to formulate some wise words to inspire you. And I was just in the room next door and I came across this book. Oh, I must have put it down. Anyway, it said, Bridge for Bright Beginners. Bridge for Bright Beginners. So I thought that was quite funny because why would bridge only be for bright beginners? Couldn't it be for all beginners? but this what we're doing is really about developing an attitude of beginner's mind. And there's a beautiful quote, how in the mind of the beginner there are many possibilities, but in the mind of the expert there are few. So really we don't want to become solidified and kind of rigid in our understanding of what practice is. We want always to be beginners. And I feel very much like a beginner and always appreciate hearing different teachers give their reflections and fellow members of the Sangha. Everyone's perspective is so unique. And there are many wonderful teachers who aren't part of this tradition, but are part of other traditions, or no tradition. So what I'd like to speak about this afternoon is both the four establishments, or the four foundations of mindfulness, and also the practice of generosity. And I think what's so beautiful to me about this particular tradition of Vipassana, Theravada Buddhism, is that it is so accessible. And I mean that in a very literal way. I mean, often the teachers I've had have mostly been Americans or Canadians. I have sat in Burma once with a Burmese Sayadaw at a monastery, which was an amazing experience. But mostly my teachers have spoken my language. And so their teachings have been very, very accessible and available to me. And there are so many wonderful talks and teachers out there that we really have no shortage of opportunities to learn from different perspectives. But the other way that it's accessible, of course, is that these teachings are given freely. And century after century, since the time of the Buddha, there has been this very deep honoring of the pricelessness of these liberating teachings. That you really can't put a price on it, and it should be available to anyone who is willing to come and explore their own mind and heart. So these teachings are given freely, and with the Victoria Insight Meditation Society, we're able to offer these retreats in this quite beautiful location, even though things are under construction, at a very reasonable cost. And the donation for the day even is not a set fee, but an invitation. So if you are able to contribute the $20 towards the registration costs, towards the rental of the place, it's very doable for most people. So just about generosity then, that these teachings are given freely to make it accessible. And we bring our own generosity by giving our time. You've given your whole day to this. You're still here. And I'm sure you have many things that are on your to-do list. But that's a beautiful, beautiful offering that you've made to yourself, that you've made to the practice, to the teachings, and that you've made to the community of people you know in your life. So with regard to the offering, this what's called dana, the word means generosity. And it's truly a practice. And it's quite a challenging practice for many people because, generally speaking, in our culture, we want to know, well, what's it worth? And last summer, I gave a retreat with a friend on Denman Island. And it was a 5-day, was called Meditation and Mandalas. And there was no set fee, but people gave something. And at the end of the retreat, I got a ride into Courtney, and my father picked me up. And he said, "Did they pay you?" That was his first comment, you know. Not how was it? How did it go? But did they pay you? And I understand, you know, that's really where he's coming from, is that in his mind, things have value according to a certain price or fee, and that's monetary. And I had to reflect on the amazing experience of being with my friend who's an artist, and the people who participated, and doing the mandalas, and the beauty of the center where we were. And I said, yes, I was paid very, very well. But we didn't mean the same thing. So it's important to ask, you know, what is it worth? And if we can give, we can. And if we can't, then what is it worth to me to make a commitment to this practice and see how it informs and transforms my life? And then the third thing about generosity is that every time we give, whether we give our time, our energy, our attention, our resources, every time we give, there is a kind of softening of a sense of self that takes place, which is tremendously freeing. So we know how good it feels to give, because actually giving is a form of letting go of me, of mine, of what I think I need. And that letting go is a preparation for the ultimate letting go, which all of us will have to do. Letting go of loved ones and letting go of life itself. So generosity is a beautiful practice, and it's really an invitation to see how can I contribute to these teachings by supporting them. And any generosity that I receive, it permits me to go on retreats and to support my teachers. So there's this beautiful circle of giving. The energy of giving stays in motion. And in one of those two anthologies of generosity stories, I speak a little bit about this, how in many Native American First Nation communities, the understanding of the gift is that it is only ours temporarily, and then it is to be passed along, and passed along, and passed along again. And this cycle of giving and circle of giving is what sustains the entire community. So generosity is sustaining, not just for the one giving or the one receiving, but for the entire community. So mindfulness and the foundations of practice. Here we are, and we've been exploring mindfulness of the breath, mindfulness of the body. We've been noticing sounds arising and passing away. These are mostly connected to the first establishment or the first avenue of exploration, mindfulness of the body. But there are other aspects of our experience that we can explore with this same attitude of interest, the same compassionate, loving awareness. And so the second foundation or establishment is on the level of feelings. And when I say feelings, I think for many of us what comes to mind is feeling happy, feeling sad. But actually in this case, the word vedana, the Pali word, refers to how every moment of experience has this pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral quality. And we can especially notice this in a meal situation when we're eating. So, can we be aware of pleasant? You know, there's hunger, then there is tasting. Ah, pleasant. Taste of the apple, taste of the raisin, taste of the salad. You know, enjoying and tasting. But being aware of pleasant means that we know this moment of pleasant and we don't try and hold on to it. We don't try and repeat it to the extent that we're no longer noticing the unpleasant of satiation or overfullness. So this is the second foundation. And it's not just with food, of course, but it's anything that comes into our experience. Can we notice pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? So for example, taking out your compost or your garbage, you notice a raccoon has been into the garbage can and it's your neighbor's garbage is strewn all over the parking area in your home, by your home. So maybe there's an aversion, a moment of aversion, but there's noticing unpleasant. Oh, unpleasant. This is unpleasant. And it's quite subtle, actually, because usually we're reactive. Usually we're either holding on to experience or pushing it away, or we're in a kind of fog about whether it's one or the other. But it's worth exploring, actually, especially in situations where we tend to get aversive or overly attached. The third establishment of mindfulness is mindfulness of mental states. And the word actually in Pali is citta, which means both mind and heart. So the seat of awareness is said to be both the heart and the mind. So awareness of mental states encompasses all the different variations from irritation, to restlessness, to doubt, to self-judgment, to blame, jealousy, anger, exhilaration, exuberance, joy, happiness, you know, contentment. Just the full range, this glorious range of experience that we all encounter. And some are definitely more challenging for us. And as I was saying to someone in our group earlier, sometimes these mental states can be overwhelming. So how can we touch in and recognize what's happening without being subsumed into this wave of sorrow or wave of grief or this, you know, experience of anxiety or panic or fear? So to be able to be mindful, to actually see if we can recognize physical sensations in the body that accompany those mental states, to notice that those sensations are not solid and unchanging, but that there is, you know, a tingling or a heaviness followed by a tightness and a contraction followed by a shifting of energy. So noticing that often what we think of as my sorrow or my fear or my anger is actually a constellation of different sensations coming and going. a shifting, pulsating, tingling, all these different things coming and going. So mindfulness reveals the composite nature of experience. And at the same time, there can be a sense of it being perhaps too much for this particular moment. And so then we move and place our attention on something quite simple, quite neutral, like sounds coming and going, or the sensation of the breath, or even just the body sitting. Coming home to something quite simple and clear. So the fourth establishment or fourth foundation of mindfulness is sometimes called categories of experience or phenomena. And it's called Dhamma or Dhammanupassi, being aware of these shifting experiences. And so I'll just give you an example of this, and that would be the five hindrances. So, this word hindrance is an interesting one because it isn't really a word we use much in our culture. But I guess another word would be obstacles, or some translations translate it as afflictions of mind. But the hindrance really is, can be seen as the ways in which we get lost, that we get pulled away from attending to our experience. We get pulled away from this willingness to investigate and explore what it means to be here in this body with this set of conditions in this moment of my life. So it's always helpful to have a list, and as you'll discover as you explore this path, that these lists are actually quite useful. And it comes out of the fact that this tradition is an oral tradition and was passed down orally for many centuries. So lists are a good way of remembering. So the first one is desire for sense pleasure. So we all know what that is. Desire for the hot bath, the cup of tea, the pleasure of lying down in a comfortable bed at the end of the day, sunshine, pleasant sights, pleasant sounds, smells, tastes, bodily sensations, as well as pleasant mental states. So we have to really look and see how the energy of desire keeps us seeking for something else, something more, or even the same thing again, experienced as fresh and new. So it's interesting to think about that, how when we have had a pleasant sensation, like a bowl of hot chocolate or a cup of tea or a cookie, you know, the first few tastes are tremendously satisfying. It's like, oh, just what I needed, you know, just what I wanted, just perfect. But then there is a tendency to want to recreate that first moment, which is impossible because it's already passed. We can only try and be with the second moment or the third moment and stay attentive, noticing pleasant. Noticing the moment when pleasant is enough. One of these quotes I think it's from the Tao Te Ching, says, "The secret waits for eyes unclouded by longing." That's an interesting one. Eyes unclouded by longing. And it really speaks to how perception can be distorted by endless wanting. So the example is given of the pickpocket who meets a saint but doesn't recognize the saint's saintliness. All he sees is the saint's pockets and what he might be able to reach for in those pockets. So the second of the five hindrances is aversion. And I have to speak honestly here, you know, as a teacher of elementary school, though I adore children, I'm working quite a lot with aversion to the amount of noise in the classroom and the disorder and the way children are sometimes with each other. And I'm constantly calling up patience and loving kindness and equanimity. And it's challenging, but I guess it is. It's good practice for me. So fear, judgment, and boredom are all forms of aversion. And really, it's interesting to think of that because boredom can feel kind of neutral, but actually it's just a lack of interest. And the third one is sloth and torpor. Such great words, sloth and torpor. Again, words we don't hear much in our culture. But it's this lack of energy, this dullness, sleepiness, laziness that can be quite a big obstacle in our practice. And even this sense of, oh, I can't be bothered, you know. So we need to investigate and be willing to investigate the hindrance of sloth and torpor. See whether there is a genuine need for rest or whether there is enough energy to actually be mindful of it, to notice how it shifts and changes. And then the fourth one is restlessness. And I think this is probably my favorite hindrance or the hindrance that loves me the most because of my incessant planning. I don't know if any of you are planners. Nod your head if you're a planner. Yes. I think there's something so compelling about making plans. It's just seductive, this ways in which we create our future version of ourselves. Steve Armstrong talks about how when you make a plan, in a sense you condemn yourself to living it out. Which I suppose it isn't a bad thing, but you've really, I mean, there are times for planning and there are times to let go of planning. And to know that it generates a lot of restlessness and a sense of the moment not being enough. Can I use this moment to, you know, plan this or plan that, prepare for this, prepare for that? And then the last one is doubt. And doubt is an interesting one because it's really this, again, a feeling of insufficiency. Maybe this isn't quite right. I don't think I'm up for this, you know, or can't seem to let go of thinking, so meditation mustn't be for me. So it's those thoughts of self-judgment or just this voice that says, oh, why bother? I don't think so. But the thing that's interesting about doubt is that it diminishes the more we taste the fruit of our practice. The more we actually have a daily practice, attend retreats, do some reading, and we see that there is tremendous benefit. We feel it, we see it, We see it in our relationships, in our conversations. We recognize that we're becoming more the person we want to be. So becoming aware of the five hindrances is one aspect of the fourth foundation of mindfulness, categories of experience. So we talk about the practice, and we talk, you know, in the West, we are mostly very interested in the mechanics of meditation. What is it? How do I do it? What does it look like? How should I feel? We want the manual, you know, we want the blow-by-blow instruction. But the whole other aspect of practice is ethical conduct and how we are in the world. So these are the five precepts. And, you know, the Buddha, he spoke about how we encounter suffering. We know the truth of suffering through our own experience. So that's called the first of the Four Noble Truths. Another list here. But the first noble truth is just recognizing suffering exists. Suffering is present. It's not that life is suffering, but that there exists suffering. And the word suffering is a translation of the Pali dukkha, just a wonderful evocative word, but is also translated as dissatisfaction or stress. And it makes me think, I might have mentioned this before, but it makes me think of this beautiful German word. Does anyone speak German here? Yes? This word is Sonntagsunzufriedenheit, the dissatisfaction that you feel on a Sunday. On a Sunday. Yeah. Kind of interesting, isn't it? Very, again, very evocative. So dukkha is just part and parcel of being human, that suffering exists. But what the Buddha discovered in his path and in his awakening was that there is an end to suffering. He discovered that there is suffering and that the source of it is this tendency we have to reach and grasp for experience. Grasping is the source of suffering. But the third noble truth is that there is an end to it. And the end is the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Noble Path. So we have lists within lists here. And this is the path of practice. And we are on that path right now, by being here together, by supporting each other, by exploring mindfulness. And the path begins with what is called right view or wise view. And wise view is the understanding that our actions have results. And it's really this grasping the truth of karma. And the word karma or kama in Pali literally means actions. And it's this recognition that when actions are consciously performed, they have a result. So when we trip and fall going down the stairs, it's not that somebody's getting even with us, you know, that there's some retribution for something we've done. Rather, it's recognizing that when we consciously perform an act of kindness, performed an act of generosity, or practice mindfulness, we are setting up conditions for wholesome mental states to be developed and to continue to be developed in our lives and in future lives. So wise view is this understanding that our actions have results. And so the five precepts are these five guidelines for thinking about an enacting wise view. And the first one is non-harming. So, I undertake the training to refrain from harming living beings. And this is a very wide-ranging precept, because we are inescapably, inextricably linked with other beings in everything we do. Even if we become vegetarians, you know, we're still perhaps using products that depend on, you know, the abuse or use of animals. Even when we become vegans, you know, there's still the consideration of how our consumer choices affect others. So, I mean, it's a bigger discussion, but it's for each one of us to think about refraining from harming living beings. And in tropical cultures and tropical countries, of course, that often means how do we relate to insects? And I suppose even in Victoria, you know, we do have what we call pests. And how are we going to relate to that creature scurrying in the wall at night? Or, you know, the bugs that we don't want to see. So it's about having a skillful and conscious attitude in our relationship to living beings. And then the second precept is concerned with not taking that which is not freely offered. And it's really quite a beautiful practice to think about sufficiency and how can we simplify and really consider our use of water, our use of energy. And the third precept is regarding our sexual energy and really being attentive to how we can cause harm in the way that we express our sexual energy. How can we care for others' relationships? How can we care for ourselves by the choices we make? And I was teaching a course last fall on the Eightfold Noble Path, and we were talking about this particular precept, and there was a young woman in the group, and she shared this beautiful story. She was married, she had a toddler, she was very much in love with her husband, but on the Monday evening, just after the weekend, she told us how she had just seen her first love. And how because of our reflection on this precept, she had been very mindful and attentive of the energy that she was projecting towards this man she considered to be her first love. And she was able to be in this very clear, very conscious state of awareness with him and to appreciate him, but not to send any flirtatious or, you know, remembering times they'd had. She was just very clear with herself, mostly. And she described having that experience of seeing the man she called her first love and then of coming home and being with her husband. And she said, at that moment, I felt that I was truly married. It was so beautiful. She said, I was married 2 years ago, but it was this experience that really revealed to me that this is the man I will spend the rest of my life with. And just this beautiful consciousness of her own capacity to be clear in her energy. So it is a source of great suffering. People don't realize that they have a choice when they interact with others about what signals and signs they are transmitting or picking up. And a lot of suffering is caused because of this lack of awareness. The fourth of the five precepts is a wonderful place of exploration, and that is right speech. And really the guideline is to think about, are we saying and speaking what is necessary and what is helpful and what is timely? So it may be necessary. It may be helpful in the larger scheme of things, but is this a good time? So it's also a rich area of exploration. And then the last one is to be aware of our use of intoxicants and really to think about abstaining from anything that clouds the mind and causes heedlessness. And again, this word heedlessness, not one that we hear often, but it's this, clearly when we've imbibed certain substances, there is a lack of mindfulness that happens. So it may be a question of limiting, it may be a question of eliminating, but it's really knowing and looking to see where there is something that I am taking in that is clouding my judgment and preventing me from acting with discernment, with kindness, with mindfulness. And for me, that might be becoming aware of the compulsion to check my email, you know. And apparently, the researchers have shown that there is some kind of a chemical release, serotonin, in the brain when there's something new in your inbox. Somebody's thinking of me. I'm not sure what that is. So this, you know, practice of mindfulness is much more than just attending to the breath and developing a settled mind. It's an invitation to look and see where our actions bring happiness, where they bring suffering, and to really attend to our lives with this consideration in mind. So just a few words about mindfulness, and then I'll be interested to see if you have any reflections. So, in a moment of mindfulness, all the other factors of awakening are present. And these are factors like tranquility, joy, investigation, energy. Bhikkhu Bodhi is a monk who lives in New Jersey, but who spent many years in Sri Lanka. He's an amazing translator of the Buddhist teachings. He talks about this cultivation and application of mindfulness to be open, quiet, alert, contemplating while riding the changes of events without getting swept away in the tides of distracting thoughts. So we get easily lost in proliferation about experience. We might have an experience, but then we add to it a story. So mindfulness is really the non-conceptual experience. There's this opportunity to just be with seeing, with hearing, tasting, and to know it for what it is without adding the story that usually has me or I at the start of it. So a lot more could be said about mindfulness, but let's just finish with a poem. This is from Hafiz, great Sufi teacher, poet. It's called Becoming Human. Once a man came to me and spoke for hours about his great visions of God he felt he was having. He asked me for confirmation, saying, "Are these wondrous dreams true?" I replied, "How many goats do you have?" He looked surprised and said, "I am speaking of sublime visions, and you ask about goats?" And I spoke again, saying, "Yes, brother. How many do you have?" "Well, Hafiz, I have 62. "And how many wives?" Again he looked surprised, then said, "4. "How many rose bushes in your garden? How many children? Are your parents still alive? Do you feed the birds in winter?" And to all he answered. Then I said, "You asked me if I thought your visions were true. I would say that they were, if they make you become more human, more kind to every creature and plant that you know." So let's just sit for a minute. Quivering, wavering, this mind, hard to guard, hard to check. The wise one makes it straight, like the fletcher, the arrow's shaft. So I think we'll move into a walking period and come back for closing instructions and a closing sit. And thank you for staying to the end. Please come back. And because some very secret instructions will be delivered at the end, and you'll miss them if you slip away now.